Good morning. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Rick Heemstra. I'm a member of the Pastors Council here at Sunnyside. That means that occasionally I get to come and preach. In the 18th century, that's the 1700s, Europe started to experience the Industrial Revolution. This was the dawn of the age of machines, where before people may have been farmers or artisans who worked with their hands in small shops, now people moved into the cities to work in factories. And these factories were dangerous, the pay was poor, people were frequently injured, and not just sudden injuries like a cut, they were injured by the work that they had to do. There are stories of people whose bodies were deformed, spines deformed, limbs that would stop working because they were forced to become part of the machinery of the factory. The Industrial Revolution was an idea. It was an idea of a mechanical world that was thought of as progress, and the people who worked in those factories did the jobs or the parts of the process that they hadn't been able to figure out how to get the machine to do yet. And it wasn't just adults that worked there. Children worked in these factories. Now, let me just give you a taste of labor law progress at the time. It was Methodists who were leading the charge in England to help the laborers in the factories, specifically children. There were many people who contributed to the passage of the 10 hours factory bill in England, but we usually credit Lord Shaftesbury with the bill. And the 10 hours factory bill limited the workday for children in factories to 10 hours, because prior to this, many children worked 16 or 18 hours a day in factories. Children, think of a 7-year-old working 16 or 18 hours. Well, what else was going on in Europe at the time? This was the time of the French Revolution. It was a bloody period in the time in France. And if you've read Les Misérables, this is set around that time. It's the time of the Napoleonic Wars. It's the time of the American Revolution. And the people revolted, and they opted for revolution because industrialization and other factors made life nasty, brutish, and short. And this was also the time of the Wesleyan revivals, or what we sometimes call the Great Awakening. It was a time when John Wesley went to the factory gates, the gates of these inhumane factories, to tell people about God's love. And he did more than preach, though. The Industrial Revolution tore people out of their towns and their communities. It demanded that they work long hours that destroyed family life. And people drank heavily to forget. And they became isolated cogs in factory machinery, and Wesley organized them into small groups that he called classes. And then he took those classes and he organized them into larger groups that he called societies, and these people cared for each other. And they helped each other with their addictions. And this was the method in Methodism. Wesley wasn't just a preacher. He was interested in many things, and he was a bit of an amateur public health official, being interested in anything that would improve the lives of people caught up in these squalid conditions. And if you've ever heard the phrase, cleanliness is next to godliness, that was John Wesley. Because John knew that people who were cleaner would tend to be healthier. And so while he promoted the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, he encouraged people to be clean, that is, to have good hygiene. I mention this because the two ideas of hygiene and goodness, of cleanness and goodness, go hand in hand in the way that we talk about them. We say things like, he got in there and got his hands grubby. And by that we mean he did something wicked. Or even the song that we just sang, give us clean hands, give us pure hearts. We put those together. Those are juxtaposed because they're kind of like the same thing. But there's a social component to being clean as well. Many cultures have this idea that one must be clean in order to come into our societies. And this was the principle behind what we experienced during COVID. To be clean, that is to be free from the COVID-19 virus, in order to come into the society of other people, well, you were excluded if you were unclean. Now let's think about this for a minute. Having COVID is a medical condition, but it is one with social implications. There is a sense that uncleanness is catching. I might get that from you. It's a contagion, and therefore those who are unclean should not come near those who are clean because you would contaminate them. I want us to realize that there is a social cost to uncleanness, and every society has some notion of uncleanness, the kind of social uncleanness that keeps you on the outside. Now, the Bible, and we're going to start in the Old Testament, which is the part of the Bible that talks about the time before Jesus walked on the earth. We can get at the meaning of uncleanness by seeing the consequences of uncleanness. And I just want us to look at a small passage in Leviticus chapter 5. And if you have your pew Bibles and you want to read along, that's on page 73. Page 73 in Leviticus chapter 5. I'm going to read just a few verses at the front, at the beginning. Leviticus chapter 5. If anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet does not speak, he shall bear his iniquity. Or if anyone touches an unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean animal, or a carcass of an unclean livestock, or a carcass of unclean swarming things, and he is hidden from him, and he has become unclean, and he realizes his guilt, or if he touches human uncleanness, of whatever sort the uncleanness may be, with which one becomes unclean and it is hidden from him, when he comes to know it and realizes his guilt, or if anyone utters with his lips a rash oath to do evil or to do good, or any sort of rash oath that people swear and it is hidden from him, when he comes to realize it and he realizes his guilt in any of these, when he realizes his guilt in any of these and confesses the sin he has committed, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation for the sin that he has committed a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him and his sin. So there are a number of things in this passage. We have a mixture of things that are arguably about hygiene, like touching dead animals, and we have moral failures, the telling lies and swearing rash oaths. Both made you unclean. And the remedy is the same for both. You were to offer a sin offering, and the sin offerings were offered so that you could come into the presence of God in the temple. And there's a knock-on effect with this, because if you can come into the temple, you can come into the place where God's people are as well. So there's necessarily a social dimension to being made right with God. So those who are clean can, in some way, come into contact with God and his people. So cleanness, at least in a religious sense, is about fitness for a relationship with God. And in the Bible, starting at the beginning with Adam and Eve, what makes us unclean is something that the Bible calls sin. And sin, at its core, is a relational break. If I lie to you, that's a sin. But the sinfulness of that lie, the essence of that lie, is that it makes it just like I hit you. Because both hitting and lying break our relationship. And sometimes we think of sin as doing a thing. It is doing a thing, but in its essence, it is breaking a thing. It is breaking a relationship. Now, turn with me to Exodus chapter 20. You can find that on page 54 if you're following along. That's the second book in the Bible near the front, Exodus chapter 20, verse 54. This is where you find the Ten Commandments. It's also found in Deuteronomy chapter 5, but we're going to look at the Exodus chapter 20 version. Even people who don't know a lot about Christianity, they usually know that there is something called the Ten Commandments, and it is a sin to break them. And I've talked about this in a recent sermon, but I want to point this out again. There are two kinds of commandments in this list of Ten Commandments. The first four deal with our relationship with God, and the last six deal with our relationships with other people. So, the God relationship commandments are, you shall have no other gods before me, you shall not make an idol, and I'm paraphrasing these, You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You shall keep the Sabbath, and it says you shall keep the Sabbath to the Lord. That's what makes that a God part of the commandments. So those are 1 through 4. That's about God. Now, look at the last 6. You shall honor your father and mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. Don't steal from your neighbor. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Don't covet your neighbor's stuff. And these are all about our relationships with other people. So two kinds of relationships, our relationship with God and our relationship with others. Now, in the New Testament, the part of the Bible that begins with Jesus' birth, in the Gospel of Matthew, which is one of the stories of Jesus' life, Jesus is asked, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" So what they knew, and we may not know, is that the law refers to the Old Testament, and not just to the Old Testament, but to the first 5 books of the Old Testament. And in the first 5 books of the Old Testament, the purest distillation of the law, the great summary of the law, is the 10 Commandments. That's the short version, right? And we've just seen that in the 10 Commandments, they are about 2 kinds of relationships, our relationship with God and our relationships with other people. And Jesus has just been asked, what is the greatest commandment in the law? And I'm reading from Matthew chapter 22 right now. And what does Jesus say? He says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these 2 commandments depend all the law and the prophets." Do you see it? Love God and neighbor. That's the same structure as the 10 commandments. We have a section on loving God and on loving our neighbor. Why is God concerned that we love our neighbor? I like people to love me, but it is not natural for me to love other people. I admit, I am not that good. We're kind of used to hearing this if we've been in church, right? Love, 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 love. But it's an unusual requirement to love your neighbor. Why would God care that we love our neighbors? Well, let me suggest this. And here's where all those Sunday school lessons that we say, yeah, yeah, I've heard this 1,000 times. This is where it becomes really important. And this has huge implications for our society even today. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, it tells us that God made us, when he made us humans, he made us in his image. And there are lots of ideas about what that image is, and we're not going to get too lost in that debate. But if your neighbor in some way bears the image of God, then in some way how you treat your neighbor is how you treat God. Let me say that again. If your neighbor in some way bears the image of God, then in some way how you treat your neighbor is how you treat God. And all of this can make you unclean. We've been over many parts of the Bible today already, and we've been talking about sin, that in its essence, sin is relational. Sin is a thing, but sin in its effect is relational. Sin makes us unclean, and being unclean, not in the hygienic sense, but in the sense connected to sin, that makes us unfit to come into the presence of God. And we've seen that the breaking of our relationships with our neighbors in some way also breaks our relationship with God, because God's image is on them, and to sin against your neighbor is in some way a sin against the image of God on your neighbor. And every society, as I said, has ways in which you can become unclean, relationally unclean. And so I want us to turn now to our main passage in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 15. You can find that on page 693 in your pew Bibles. Page 693. We're going to start at verse 1, And whereas we read it, I want you to notice in this first part the relationship between being clean and being able to eat with other people. Matthew chapter 15, starting at verse 1, it says, "Then some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, 'Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands when they eat.'" So the setting here is Jesus is gathered with these Pharisees to eat. So everything that we've seen up until this point is to set us up for looking at this passage in Matthew. And this is all about cleanness. The Pharisees, they come to Jesus and they're concerned about the disciples' washing of their hands before they eat, or that they don't wash their hands before they eat. Yuck. And now this is both a question of hygiene, but it is also a question of religious purity. And I might add, it is a question of social purity. Only those who have clean hands are invited to the table to eat. What I want you to see here is that for the Pharisees in this situation, the relationship that they are concerned about is the relationship that they have with keeping a set of rules. In this case, rules about hand washing. And now Jesus is going to reply to them, and he's going to talk to them about breaking the Ten Commandments. In this case, it is the commandment about honoring your father and your mother. And so we're reading on in verse 3, and this is part of the same conversation. And Jesus says, Jesus replied, "Why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and anyone who curses their father and mother is to be put to death. But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father and mother is devoted to God," we'll talk about what that means in a minute, "they are not to honor their father and mother with it. Thus you nullify the word of God for the sake of your tradition." So the Pharisees had a practice. In order to show their extravagant devotion to God, they would make these costly gifts to God in the temple, a money gift, and they called that offering korban. But what that would do is, you know, you've only got so much money, so mom and dad, I'm sorry. I gave that money to God, so I can't really help you right now. They were doing it at the expense of their obligation to look after their father and mother. Now, it's very difficult in our culture where we assume that the government has responsibility to look after mom and dad in their old age for us to understand what a huge violation this was in many ways of social customs and everything and religious expectation to not look after your parents. And so Jesus is questioning their idea of cleanness. Is cleanness about keeping rules that may be arbitrary? Or is cleanness about the state of our relationship with God and with other people? What is cleanness really about? Now, the Ten Commandments are rules, but they are rules that are designed to keep us from breaking our relationship with God and breaking our relationships with other people. And the important thing is that we understand what is the purpose behind these rules. And so it's pretty clear here that Jesus' critique of the Pharisees over hand-washing rules were that the hand-washing rules became a cover for them breaking their relationship with their parents. And we know that sinning against other people, because they bear the image of God, that sin is also a sin against God. And this is why we confess our sins against other people to God. Do you ever wonder why we do that? I sinned against Nate, and now I'm confessing this to God. No, because in sinning against Pastor Nate and the image of God on him, I am also sinning against God. So I need to apologize to Nate, but I also need to confess that sin to God. And so Jesus kind of generalizes the teaching that he is specifically making with the Pharisees here, and he is addressing the critique about having dirty hands before eating, which is a hygiene issue, but it's also a religious issue. It's both. The concern was that what might come into your body through your hands, what's on your hands, it gets on your food, gets in your mouth, that might make you unclean. And so Jesus turns this around and he says, verse 17, "Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is expelled? What comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, And this defiles a person. For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander. These are what defiles a person. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile anyone. So we're still talking about cleanness, and here Jesus says that what makes you unclean is not what goes into your mouth, but what comes out of your mouth. And this is very interesting because the list of things that he gives, evil thoughts, adultery, sexual immorality, false witness, slander, not all of these things come out of your mouth in the way that words might come out of your mouth or your food might come out of your mouth if you throw up. But a lot of these things do deal with words. And it was assumed that our words are a reflection of our inward reality. Now, I think that anybody who's been to school knows that little rhyme, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. A more false word was never said. Words can hurt very much. I'm sure that you can think of many, many examples, both at school, at work, maybe even at church, where words hurt, and they hurt very badly. Where words have ruptured relationships with God and with others, and we sometimes excuse them and say, well, they were just careless words. But what Jesus is suggesting here is that even those careless words are often, or maybe usually, maybe always, a reflection of what is deep inside of us. And to the extent that words break relationships, they make us unclean. That's why our communities come apart. That's why our families come apart. That's why our marriages come apart. In the early part of my life, I had a more mechanistic view of the world. I didn't put a lot of stock in the power of words to harm or to heal. But what has really impressed me more recently in my life is watching good coaches. I have watched coaches say, "That was a really good play. Well done." And I have watched these players as they hear this grow an inch in front of my eyes. When I was young, I think it was about 5 or 6, I had a folded piece of paper and I cut it to where there was little strips, very much like this one, although I did a better job, I had more strips in my earlier one. And an adult came along to me and said, "What a beautiful French frill." And I just thought, I didn't know the French made these things. But I've done it, and I've done a really good one. And that kind word is just a piece of paper. I grew an inch right then. And I held on to that piece of paper for years. And I still remember my distress years later when I was looking for it and I couldn't find it. Because that piece of paper that I cut into little strips when I was 5 held those words that made me grow an inch. Words can heal when they are genuine apologies for sin, for the sins we've committed. It is a miraculous and a beautiful thing to see people reconciled. All right, we're going to go just a little bit further in this chapter in Matthew because words, our confession with words, right? When we confess things, we confess them with words. Something is coming out of our mouths. It is a reflection of our heart. And our words can make us unclean. They can break our relationships with God and with other people. But our words can take people who are otherwise unclean and make them fit to come into the presence of God and to enjoy the benefits of a relationship with God. And here's what we're going to do. So at the start of this chapter in Matthew, we have an eating story with male Pharisees. I want you to see that. It's a story about eating. At the end of this chapter, we have an eating story about a female Canaanite. Two eating stories, and in the middle is Jesus teaching about what really makes us unclean. And there is a deliberate contrast going on here. At the beginning, we have a male religious people at a meal with Jesus, whom everyone would assume is ritually clean. And at the end, you have a female non-Jewish Canaanite woman whom everyone would assume is ritually unclean. Now, who are the people watching both of these stories? It's the disciples. So it's the disciples that are learning from all of this. And the question for them is, who is really clean and on what basis? The Pharisees assumed that they were clean because they washed their hands. But the words that came out of their mouths actually broke their relationship with Jesus. And Jesus pointed out that the words they spoke to their parents, the Korban stuff, broke their relationship with their parents. Now, as we read this eating story, I want you to watch what the Canaanite woman says, and I want you to listen to what is in her heart. And I want you to see how that changes her relationship with Jesus. So, starting at verse 21. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus did not answer a word, so his disciples came after him and urged him, "Send her away. She keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." And the woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help," she said. And he said, "It is not right to take the children's bread and to toss it to the dogs." "Yes, it is," she said. "Yes, it is, Lord," she said. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's tables." Then Jesus said to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed from that moment. Look at what comes out of her heart as she appeals to Jesus. "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me." She called him Lord, Son of David. David was a Jewish king, and the expected Messiah was going to be like David. She was appealing to Jesus in his messianic role as the Jewish Savior. She's claiming the promises to the people of God. She's not Jewish. The Pharisees didn't do that. Now keep in mind who's watching. The disciples are watching. They're Jewish. They know who's clean and who isn't. Or do they? Jesus has just taught them that what makes a person unclean is what comes out of their mouth. What makes a person clean is also what comes out of their mouth, if the words are a true reflection of what's inside. We have the male Jewish, female non-Jewish contrast, and there's a further contrast between the sheep and the dogs. The sheep were a clean animal, the dogs weren't. And these are all orthodox distinctions of clean and unclean, but her confidence in Jesus, her expression of faith, is ultimately what makes her clean and able to be in the presence of Jesus and to receive grace and healing for her daughter. If you look at this chapter as a whole, the unclean ones are the Pharisees. The clean one is the Canaanite woman. And these passages really challenge us. They challenge me to think about my words and how they reflect what is in my heart. That is, how they break or restore my relationships with God and with others. It is not our social standing or whatever identity markers you might hang in the window that make us clean or unclean. It is what comes out of our hearts. And we often know what is in our hearts by the words that we say. Let me just close by saying that what we express verbally matters. This is why at baptisms we have people use their words to talk about their faith, like they give their testimony, but they actually say the words. This is why it matters that we actually say we're sorry when we hurt each other. It's not just that I feel sorry or I feel bad. The good news is that if our hearts are unclean, we believe that Jesus can change that. This is what communion is about, that we're about to partake together. You see, it's not that the Canaanite woman made herself clean. It's that she responded to Jesus as the one who could make her clean. She responded in faith and, in fact, asking Jesus to make us clean. Right? This is about prayer, right? Actually saying the words to Jesus is an expression of faith in his power to make us clean. And so let me just close with a question. What words do you need to say today?